And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we're going to talk about the possibility of underwater UFOs and also UFO healings. Incredible stories. Preston Dennett, our special guest, and we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Preston Dennett began investigating UFOs and the paranormal in 1986 when he discovered that his family, friends, co-workers, they were having dramatic, unexplained encounters. Since then, he has interviewed hundreds of witnesses, investigated a wide variety of paranormal phenomena. He's now a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, a ghost hunter, a paranormal researcher, author of 15-plus books on UFOs and the paranormal, UFOs over New Mexico, ghosts of greater Los Angeles, UFOs over New York, just to name a few. He has taught classes on various paranormal subjects, lectures around the United States. Preston Dennett on Coast to Coast. Boy, you are everywhere, Preston. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Yeah, good to have you with us. How many books have you written, 15 or 15 more?
I have 15 out and at least two upcoming.
Well, good for you. Now, what are the other two that are coming out?
One is called UFOs Over Nevada, to kind of follow up this state-by-state series.
Oh, perfect.
Started out. And another I'm working on is called Very Close Encounters, which is kind of detailing some of the most extensive abduction and onboard cases that I've investigated lately.
Preston, tell me a little bit more about yourself when you got interested back in 1986. What were the things that you were discovering about your family and friends about this?
Yeah, you know, I was the kind of guy who was actually really skeptical of this whole subject. I didn't believe it for a second. I was ready to tell anyone who said they believed or saw UFO that they were crazy or on drugs or lying, basically. And I heard about this report on the news. It's now a classic case. Pilot Kenju Tiroshi saw this UFO over Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
This was back in 1986, late 1986, and I didn't believe it for a second, and the news treated it tongue-in-cheek like they usually do. But I made the mistake of asking people about it. I started asking people at work. I'm like, did you hear about this pilot who says he saw a UFO? And I remember this clearly. The lady I worked with, I'd worked with her for years, she said, oh, I saw a UFO. Dorothy is her name. And she said it followed her home from the library, actually. And her mom saw it. It hovered right over their car. And they actually had missing time. I found out later as I interviewed her later on. And another coworker heard us talking, and she walked up. Doris was her name. And she had seen a UFO over the San Bernardino Mountains. And this was just a light object which was darting back and forth. The point is, I knew these people weren't lying to me. Either they were misperceiving. I don't know. It just sent me on this quest. I asked my family. I found out my brother had seen a UFO. My sister-in-law had had a face-to-face encounter with gray-type aliens.
Well, see, you were doing that, Preston, once you start ruling out that they're liars or they're not, once you rule that out, then you're left with the possibility that, okay, they're seeing something, but now what is it? Is it Earth-made? Is it something that's, is it a meteorite? Who knows what it is? Or is it possibly extraterrestrial? And that's where the fun begins, isn't it?
All right. Well, I picked up every book I could find. I joined every group. You know, I really got into this heavy duty because I'm not exactly sure why. It's not like I've had a history of encounters myself. It was new to me, and I was on a quest because basically it struck home. It hit me like a ton of bricks. I was not prepared for it. You know, this was not taught in schools or...
No, I wish it would be.
Really? You know... Exactly.
And I was much like you. This happened to me. 11, I had my first paranormal experience. A little bit later on, a few years later, my mother brought me home a book that Walter Sullivan had written. He was the New York Times science writer, called We Are Not Alone.
Right.
And I was always obsessed, even as a little kid, with life and space and the possibilities. And then Look magazine came out with The Interrupted Journey, the story of Barney and Betty Hill, the New Hampshire couple that they claimed that they were abducted.
Sure.
And you know what? It changed my whole career, Preston. I decided I wanted to get into broadcasting. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to uncover these stories. I wanted to interview the people who were seeing these things. And doggone it, I did it. And one of my first interviews, my first interview was with Stanton Friedman. You know him, the ufology expert. But I also interviewed Dr. Benjamin Simon, who is the psychiatrist who is responsible for Betty and Barney Hill. I was just hooked, and I would guess the same thing has happened to you.
Yeah, well, I was dragged into this field kicking and screaming. I did not want to go, honestly. But now that I'm here, I couldn't be happier. I think it's a really exciting field, and definitely there's a lot to be...
Knowing what you now know, would you do it again?
Are you kidding? A million times over.
Perfect.
Yeah, it's changed my life completely.
Perfect. Let's talk. I want to talk with you. You know, you're with me for 3 hours tonight, and I want to talk with you about several segments of the things you've researched. I am fascinated with underwater UFOs. Where has your research taken you in this area?
Right. This is something that hasn't really gotten a lot of attention. And to be honest, I kind of ignored it when I first started hearing about it. I lived in Topanga Canyon, which is, located in Southern California between Malibu, Santa Monica, right along the coast there in West L.A. And it turns out this area is a hot spot. I didn't know that at the time, but this wave of sightings occurred in 1992. And at that time, I had just, uncovered a few other cases in the area. And when this wave hit, the editor of the local messenger called me up, the local newspaper, and asked me to investigate. So I found out that there were literally hundreds of people who were seeing UFOs. And on particularly this one night, June 14th, 1992, there was a giant wave of sightings. And so this led to this really huge investigation. And in some of these cases that I started uncovering were ocean-going UFOs. And like one typical case comes from a lady named Susan Young. She's a therapist.
All right, tell us this one.
Yeah, and she's driving along with her friend. This is right along the Pacific Coast Highway, and it's at night. And she's looking out towards the ocean, and she sees what she thinks at first is a boat, but there's something strange about the light. It's not like a boat would appear, and it didn't appear to be bobbing or anything. It just looked strange to her. She couldn't quite define why, and she was just about to point it out to her friend, and they both looked, and this object, whatever it was, went straight up very, very fast, she said, and then disappeared. So that was one really early case. I'm like, huh. I started getting a couple of other cases. One guy named Tony, he said he lives along the coast there in Malibu, and he twice saw this very, very bright object floating on the water, which he was sure was not a boat. He ended up calling, the fire department, thinking maybe a boat was on fire because it was just so brilliant. But it disappeared.
There were cases of military people on ships, Navy folks, that, they'd be out in the ocean, Preston, they would be, the full moon would be there, and out of nowhere, some object, you call them, we call them USOs, unidentified submerged objects,
right,
would just smash through the bottom from the ocean, right through, and just take off and keep going. I mean, right. Can you imagine that sight?
Yeah, we have nothing that can do that, at least not that's publicly revealed. So, and the way these objects can come not only out of the water, but in, they come down, very, very fast, very high speeds and hit the water very hard, but it appears to just kind of swallow them up without even a splash often. So they have some sort of field or something that allows them to do this.
You saw the movie The Abyss, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Good movie.
Every time I see that, I think about what we're talking about here right now. I think of that movie and, these beings that lived in the sea, or at least they were camped down there for God knows how long. I assume that these submerged objects go in the water because they may use some of the water for propulsion. What do you think?
I've certainly heard that theory, and it's been brought up, and I think there's some evidence to point towards that, in that there's a lot of cases of UFOs hovering over bodies of water, both small and large.
Not that they suck all the water up in the UFO for propulsion. It's not like gasoline to them, but they're using water for something.
I'm not exactly clear what it is, but it's definitely a pattern that's prominent enough that, it's readily apparent.
Is this USO activity happening all around the planet?
Absolutely. I think probably a lot more than we realize, because the oceans are largely inaccessible to us. And we haven't even explored it as well as perhaps we've explored the surface of the moon, if you, in terms of mapping. I mean, there are lots of areas of the ocean that are just too deep that we can't get down there easily.
Are the USOs the same craft as the UFOs that people report seeing?
I think so. I think that they just have the ability to move in and out of the water
okay.
very quickly. You know, but it's not clear because, you know, this is one of the things that always bothers me about UFO research is the many different styles of UFOs. I mean, I suppose we have different styles of our own vehicles, cars and whatnot, but there's not a whole lot of consistency. We have all different kinds of shapes. And particularly over this particular area where I've found that there's a lot of underwater UFO activity, it's not just one type of UFO that's going in and out of the water here.
What about the UFO cases we hear where they track UFOs underwater? They see this object all lit up, you know, down 50, 100, 200 feet. They could see it. They can see the light moving with them.
Oh, yeah. I've got several cases like this that I have investigated, and I've talked to some people, and definitely this one particular area off the Southern California coast seems to be the most active. And what happened was I started...
And whereabouts? Whereabouts is it?
Well, I'm going to say it stretches from at least as far south as, you know, Long Beach, Rancho, Palos Verdes.
Okay.
Towards there and all the way north up to Santa Barbara. But mainly it's this one area, which is the Santa Catalina Channel. Now, this is a very deep part of the
ocean,
right off the coast.
Sure.
And right kind of next to Santa Catalina Island. And I've actually talked to some people. I was contacted by a couple of submarine guys who were telling me about some of their adventures in this area. And one guy, he contacted me after I had done some, and I wrote an article about this. I appeared on a History Channel, so I got a lot of emails from that and a lot of contacts. And this submariner who said that he was involved in navigating submarines in this area said that there is, in fact, a very, very deep trench that goes all the way up the coast to the Monterey Trench, which is one of the deeper areas of the ocean, actually. And
now, have these folks noticed anything with their sonar, any strange objects down there?
He didn't, but I was contacted by another guy who said he was on a Navy ship that was right off the coast there when this was at night, when they saw these very bright, bright objects, kind of a series of them, maybe a couple of miles out to sea towards, you know, the seaside. And they were just glowing and hovering there and blinking in patterns. And it caused a whole uproar over the ship because they could not be identified. And I've got a couple of cases like that, actually, of people who've contacted me from the military.
Have you heard about the case in the Baltic Sea, this huge object they found that's down there and nobody's gone down there yet to investigate it?
I did. I did hear about that. And that's one of those cases I'm wondering, are we going to hear more about it? Because you hear about cases like this and they disappear.
Well, we're not going to let it go. I don't know what it is, but it's pretty darn big. I think it's bigger than most old ships at the time. So I don't think it's one of those.
Well, this is what I'm saying. The ocean, I think there's a lot of stuff going down out there. It's easy for us to, you know, record the skies and the movement of UFOs in the air, but the oceans could very well be swarming with these things. We don't really know.
You know, if we could drain the oceans for one day, just for a day, do you imagine the things we'd find there? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well, I think...
Scattered everywhere.
I think there might be some sort of a base off the Southern California coast because the kind of cases I was, you know, and I can date it back, I think, to at least 1947.
Now, are people seeing objects pierce the water?
Oh, yeah.
They are.
They're coming both out of the water as early as 1951, and there's many cases after that, and also coming down and landing on the water or just going straight in. Or, you know, for that matter, there's several cases of boaters. And I can talk about all these cases in more detail.
Okay, yeah, give us a couple of your best cases.
Well, it started in 1951 when Harold Wilkins, he started uncovering cases where people were seeing these objects coming in and out of the water. This was off the Southern California coast.
Okay.
And there were kind of brief cases, but to me, I think one of the best cases occurred in, let me see, what was the date of that? I have that right here.
Well, that's okay. Back 50s, 60s, probably.
It was August or January 15th, 1956.
Okay.
Okay. And
I was six.
I was not quite alive yet.
You were just in their imagination.
But this is a really interesting case. This occurred in Redondo Beach when multiple residents in this area, including lifeguards, some police officers, and a whole bunch of residents, watched this very large object, which they described as being about 12 feet across, glowing bright orange, and it just kind of floated down out of the sky and landed about 75 yards offshore. And it was just sitting there as more and more people were gathering to watch this. And so they started calling, the more police, and the military eventually did arrive as well. But at this point, the object sank beneath the surface, and it was bubbling and leaving this kind of froth, and it just disappeared and went. No one could see it any longer. So at this point, they brought in divers. The police were able to bring in divers, and they dove for it, even using radiation and Geiger counters. And they were not able to find it. But what's really interesting...
That is fascinating.
This caused a whole press uproar, and the Air Force, or the Coast Guard, I forget which one, released a statement saying that this was actually caused by a light buoy, which has a light on it. How you can say something, came out of the sky that was 12 feet.
Right. Buoys don't do that. Buoys don't fly.
So that was a really good.
And they're also, I don't think they're 12 feet, are they? Some of them are big, but they're not that big, are they?
I don't think so.
No. No. I mean, some of them could be 3 to 6 feet, like bells, big bells.
Right. And another really good case was actually an intercepted message from a steamship.
All right. What did they say?
A Japanese steamship called the Aliki, and this occurred on August 8th, 1954.
So you had a lot of cases in the 50s.
Oh, yeah. This is when it started, apparently. And so these UFOs were moving in and out of the water, at will. And this intercepted message describes this fireball that was seen moving in and out of the ocean without being doused. And it started moving in a darting pattern and eventually just moved away from sight.
Yeah, meteors will go in, but they're not coming back up.
Right? So this is the kind of cases that, I started finding. And I uncovered a bunch of these types of cases. And some of them, are more intense than others. Like, here's a case which occurred in 1962. And this is pretty much the only case I have which involves occupants.
Oh, tell me about this.
Yeah, it's interesting, and this was actually revealed by Jim and Coral Lorenzen of APRO, who were, pioneering investigators.
Right.
And so they were impressed by it.
That's way back.
And right. And so this involves a fishing boat, and the captain noticed some lights floating stationary about 6 miles south of Catalina Island. Now, so this is always the same area around Catalina Island, I found, which is having these encounters. And this captain is looking at it, and he thinks it's a submarine. It looks like maybe a Russian submarine. And he said he could see 5 men, 2 who were dressed in white and 2 who were dressed in a dark pants and white shirts, and 1 wearing a kind of a weird blue jumpsuit.
Huh.
And so they came right up to this object, and they said it looked like a submarine. They were about a quarter mile away. It was steel gray. It had no markings, and only this really weird aft structure.
Hold on for a second. We're going to let you finish this story, Preston, and it's a dandy in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight, Preston Dennett. We're talking about his work, noted author and UFO researcher, but this moment we're going to talk with him about USOs. That's right, unidentified submerged objects. That's next. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. So, Preston, so what they saw was they saw occupants standing on top of what looked like a submarine. They get close to it. What happens?
Right. Mind you, this submarine wasn't moving at the time. So suddenly all these figures, they go inside the submarine, which at this point turns and heads straight for the boat. And it's right about to ram it when it actually turns and dives and disappears. And at the time, what was weird about it is it emitted no noise that they could hear and left no real wave at all.
Now, how do we know it was not a real submarine?
Well, this is where it gets interesting.
All right.
Because the captain decides to contact the Navy. He decides what he saw is important. And he is interviewed by this gentleman who starts showing him all these various silhouettes of submarines, including Japanese and German and Russian and so on. And he's looking at them all, and he's like, nope, that's not it, that's not it. None of these things that he saw were familiar. So what he saw is still a mystery. And this is where Jim Coral-Lorenzen decided, you know, this might be something very unusual here.
But he did not see it pierce the water and take off.
No, not in this case.
Darn. That's the one we want to see.
But, you know, there was just recently this boat that they said...
Well, let me ask you, did the occupants look, could he tell, did they look human or very weird? Strange.
They're not really described in the report, so I don't know for sure, but apparently they were just normal-looking men, which, you know, is not that unusual. I'm getting more and more reports of just normal-looking, human-looking ETs.
Well, you know, one of my theories, Preston, that, you know, if there are ETs out there, and I believe they are, there's a high probability they could look like we look, because we may be who they are. You know, if we were seated by them, then well, that's we look like them. We are them.
Right. I agree. At first, it really bothered me. I thought this was too easy. This was too science fiction, too Star Trek. But you're kind of stuck with the stories. And I think it does speak to, you know, human evolution and who are we really if there are ETs that look just like us.
What are some of your conclusions about the USOs? What have you come to?
Well, I think that there's some sort of underwater base, to be perfectly honest.
All over the planet or just around Catalina?
I think in the Catalina area there is. Or if not a base, there's certainly a large parking lot.
At least one.
At least. And there are, I think, other places where there are is more active than normal.
Puerto Rico's one of them.
Right. And Florida certainly had some activity. I was contacted not too long ago by another person who said he had a really interesting encounter.
Well, I would guess if they're hiding, that's the best place to go.
Very, very nice place to hide. You know, and if they wanted access to a very large population base, such as L.A., without being detected, it's the perfect place to hide because we cannot chase them, not effectively. Not with any numbers.
And if they come out at night and, you know, pierce the water and go off into space, not a lot of people will see that.
Exactly. Exactly. So this could be very, very common. So it's hard to say. Here's another really interesting case which occurred in 1980. And this is...
80. All right. So we're getting a little more current here.
Right. Yeah, I've got lots of current cases, actually. I was just emailed, if you can believe it, just a week and a half ago by just another person who had a really incredible encounter, actually. But this 1980s case is one of my favorite because it occurred to a senior electronics engineer. This is, you know, not your typical Joe Blow. This guy's, you know, educated. And he actually owned a boat also, this is interesting, which was fully equipped, had all sorts of, you know, depth sounders and things like this. So he's going along this area on a foggy day between kind of Santa Barbara Island and Santa Cruz Island. And he sees this fluorescent green-colored mist ahead of him in the fog. He's like, oh, no, you know, it's another ship. So he stops and waits for it to pass. And it starts approaching him, heading directly towards him. And it's about a quarter mile away at first, and then basically it comes right under him. And he was able to measure it as being approximately 300 feet. He wasn't sure how far it was underneath him, but he had a 38-foot sailboat. And so he's taking depth readings, with trying to determine how far down this object is. And it's measuring at about 100 feet. And at this point, both his depth sounders quit working. His compasses started rotating. His radio went dead. And, you know, at this point, he started getting really frightened.
Sure.
And the object actually moved away. So, and his compass was permanently broken after that. And it really, really scared him very badly.
What was the case? It was near Canada. It was in a lake. And the object stayed on the bottom for a long time. Or was it off of New York? I talked about it 2 years ago. I just can't remember it right now.
Yeah, I know which case you're talking about. I forget the area, but yeah, this object, I remember
it
that.
Was up that way.
It swooped down and stayed there for like 3 days.
Yes, and then it slowly moved away underwater. And then I think it shot up and it was gone.
Yeah, I remember that case. The military was down there diving.
They sent divers down there.
Very well identified case. Lots of witnesses. Really remarkable case.
Yeah, let's find out where that was before I go crazy. You ever get that way? You know something, and if you don't have the answer or if it's not right at the tip of your tongue, you go nuts until you get it?
I'll think of it.
Yeah, we will find it. That's part of your projects tonight, Preston.
Okay.
Now, what other people, who else might be investigating these USOs?
You know, I arrived kind of late on the UFO scene in, you know, the late 1980s, and I was really shocked to find out, you know, people had been researching this for years. And not surprising.
Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia, Canada. That's it.
Yep, Shag Harbor. Great case.
We've got quick listeners.
So, yeah, other researchers have definitely found cases just like this. You know, Anne Druffel, she was investigating strange cases off the coast. Bill Hamilton. I know Barbara Lamb.
Know them all, yep.
She's uncovered a case of an abduction, I know, along the coast there. I've uncovered at least, you know, a half dozen abduction cases.
Do you think government knows what's going on here?
How could they not? Absolutely. And I think there's evidence of that. You know, during the Topanga Canyon UFO wave, there was some definite government interference with witnesses. And one gentleman, he's a teacher at a college. He woke up and saw these black helicopters basically chasing this object down towards the coast. And I had another person call me. He said that, you know, I think it was his brother or his friend who went diving off the coast there, and the Navy came up. This is not far from Point Magoo. So Point Magoo is a naval base right there on the north tip of all this activity.
Well, see, I think what's fascinating, not the objects that plunge into the water, because you can think they could be meteors or anything else. It's the objects that come out of the water.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I heard about this one case. I was not able to get a first-hand interview, but you know, I think it's a pretty reliable case of these two ladies who will go to the and do UFO watching, basically, because every night at the same time, this object would come out of the water. And what's really interesting is they never saw it come back in. It would always just come out. So, you know, what's down there? I think there's a base, honest to God, and I have some really good reasons to think that, actually.
Well, let us continue. So, what do you think is under Antarctica?
No, we don't know. I think that we're definitely going to get some surprises as we, you know, develop our technology or we use it to explore these areas. Or, you know, with global warming going on, I think we're going to find some stuff under the ice cap as well. That's going to surprise people.
Do you think there could be some bases there?
It would be a very good place, wouldn't it? No, because that's a very hard place for us to reach. And apparently these ETs, and you know, I'm a big believer that that's the explanation for this whole phenomena. I think that they would definitely take advantage of that.
Well, I think so, too. Let's talk a little bit about your healing and UFO healing. What's going on there?
Yeah, now this was, you know, something I investigated early on, actually, when I first got involved in UFO research. And UFO healing can be defined as basically an encounter in which someone has experiences a physiological improvement as a result of a UFO encounter. And I think they're pretty rare, but not nearly as rare as, you know, a lot of people might think. Because every time I lecture about this subject, you know, someone approaches me and tells me their story. So clearly this is not totally unusual. And it's a fairly consistent feature in some UFO encounters. But nevertheless, for the most part, these cases have been relegated to almost a trash heap because they were very hard to believe, even for UFO researchers. So they really didn't get a lot of attention for a long, long time.
You know, there were cases where people have been hurt from UFOs. You know, I cite movies a lot because they're easy to illustrate. You know, it paints pictures in people's minds. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. You remember Richard Dreyfuss, his face, how red it was, the right side of his face?
Right.
We've had cases like that, real cases, haven't we?
Oh, absolutely. You know, John Schussler, he's the guy who headed MUFON. He uncovered at least 400 cases of UFO injuries. What's interesting, for the most part, these were eye irritation or burns, like you said. Some were scars, you know, from abduction cases and things like this.
Remember the Betty Cash, Vicki Landrum case?
Oh, tragic, yeah.
Back in the 80s, did something happen to them? I think they got very sick.
Oh, they sure did, immediately after their encounter and for years afterwards.
Right.
And whether that was a government thing or not is hard to say because that object was surrounded by helicopters. But absolutely, there are many cases of UFO injuries. But for the most part, or often, they seem to be accidental. People get too close to these objects and, you know, they get burned. Whereas the UFO healing cases. And
what do you mean by UFO healing cases? What does that mean?
People are being healed by these objects, and a healing can be anything from colds to cancer, honestly.
Intentionally, or do they just stumble up to it and then they're okay?
You get all kinds. For the most part, I think that it's hard to say. Cause there are some cases where people are just healed by being in the near presence of a UFO, and it doesn't appear to be intentional at all. On the other hand, there are cases where it's definitely, people are taken on board or they experience what amounts to a house visit by these ET guys and are cured. So these cures fall into a number of different categories, but basically they're healings of flesh wounds, healings of chronic conditions, healings of all different kinds of illnesses. I mean, the list is really quite extensive.
How far can the UFO be when it heals someone? I mean, can it be to a point where, let's say someone has cancer and a UFO beams something down. You can't even see the UFO, so they have no idea what happened to themselves, but they're cured. Have we had strange cases like that where they're just cured and they don't have any idea why?
Well, there's a case very much like that. A Peruvian customs official walked out on his balcony, and there was this tiny object, you know, pretty far up there.
Way out there, yeah.
And he's looking at it, trying to figure out what it is, and it sends down this violet beam of light, which strikes him on the head and chest, and stuns him pretty bad, and he stumbles back inside. And he suffered from rheumatism and nearsightedness. And he says his nearsightedness was immediately gone, and his rheumatism cleared up very quickly afterwards. And he attributes it to this beam of light that hit him. And lots of cases like that. A French doctor, and this was first investigated by Jacques Vallée, a really prominent researcher.
One of the best.
And he was one of the few people who actually paid attention to these types of cases. So I have to, you know, give him a hand to that. And this was a really interesting case. This doctor was struck by a beam of light from a UFO, and it's, again, the same thing. It stunned him really bad. He stumbled back into his room, and it was the next morning, I believe, that he woke up and realized that he was no longer paralyzed. He had been partially paralyzed in one leg from the Algerian War. Paralysis was gone. Not only that, he had a very, really bad flesh wound on his ankle, and it was completely healed. I mean, like, just gone. Jeez.
Now, are they doing this to help out, or are they doing this to let us know they can do this?
I think both. You know, I looked for patterns. It's hard to say why some people are being healed than others. And the only real pattern I could find, and it was very loose, but it was there, was that some of the people who are being healed are doing good work for humanity. And a typical example is John Hunter Gray, who, you know, has earned several awards for social work.
Yeah.
And he had a remarkable healing in Wisconsin. And so he's a typical example, but, you know, police officers, inventors, doctors, even entertainers, these are the types of people who appear to be being healed.
Are they being healed primarily from some kind of beam of light?
Light play a very prominent role, but it's certainly not the only thing that these ETs use. They use pretty much the same methods we use, honestly. They do surgery. But for the most part, the instruments are, you know, not something we would recognize.
They're
not, you know, scalpels or anything like that.
It's not like good old Doc Bones and what he had, huh? Star Trek.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should say that, because there are cases like that where aliens have held sort of a handheld instrument over a person's body and sealed up cuts on them. Now, here's one of my favorite cases. This occurred in
a healing case?
Yeah, this is a healing case of a flesh wound.
All right.
Occurred on September 3rd, 1965 in Texas, actually, Dane in Texas.
2 years after Kennedy got killed.
Right. And what's interesting about this is there were two police officers who were the witnesses, Deputy Robert Good and Chief Deputy Billy McCoy. And they were actually returning from a high school football game when they saw this very, very large object rising up from the side of the road. And it was sort of a football-shaped, and it was sending down this purple light. And this purple light struck their car, and Deputy Good says he could actually feel it on his arm. Now, what's interesting is Deputy Good had been bitten by an alligator, his son's pet baby alligator, on his finger.
And they don't let go.
Right. So he had a wound, which was, you know, nasty. It was swollen and painful, bandaged up. And he could feel it striking this arm. They race away from the UFO in terror and park at a diner and start talking about the experience. And that's when he realized that his finger didn't hurt. And he whipped off the bandage. And this is something, you know, that's straight out of Star Trek. The cut was gone. So it's basically healed instantly. So that's a pretty impressive case. And what's really interesting about it is they were investigated by the Air Force, by a Major Leach from Ellington Air Force Base, who could not explain the case. And it ended up being a very well-known case, highly publicized, and is considered a classic today.
Well, you know, I like the fact that they're helping out.
Right? You know, I think the media, to a large extent, specifically television, is often fear-based. And you don't hear about these benevolent encounters. And another reason you don't hear a lot about them is because these people aren't seeking help. They've already been helped, so they don't need to be, you know, they're not traumatized often. So they don't feel any need to seek out help. And certainly, it's hard to convince someone that you've been healed by.
Well, you're right. I mean, the news is generally tragedy-based or some kind of event or catastrophe. I don't think in my entire career that spans back to the beginning of time, I don't think I remember one news story that a television newscast, led by saying things like, 8 people had a birthday today and the cake was gorgeous. And, you know, nobody ever starts something with a happy story. It's always the negative, the murder, the doom, the gloom, because I think it grabs people's attention.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that, and it's unfortunate, because I think that there's a whole benevolent side to the whole UFO phenomena, and to a large extent, they've gotten a bad rap. And certainly when it comes to UFO abductions, I think, you know, when I first started researching, I thought, oh, this is horrible. These are floating torture chambers who are, you know, stripping people. And
well, Whitley Strieber would tell you that. Preston, stay with us. We're coming back for more on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about UFOs that heal people and UFOs that just submerge themselves in the water. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.